Our first case for this morning is case number 082467 and 082595, Duran versus the Town of Cicero. Mr. Cerda?
May it please the court, counsel. Plaintiffs are seeking a retrial of their case because they did not receive a fair trial in certain respects. The first issue I'd like to raise is plaintiff's spoliation claim. The issue before the court is whether under Illinois law a police officer can, with impunity, stop a citizen from videotaping police misconduct mid-incident. In this case, a professional videographer, Luis Castaneda, was videotaping the front of the Duran home when defendant officer Lewandowski illegally ordered him to stop the recording. Because of that unlawful order, evidence was not preserved, which would have helped to prove plaintiff's case. The Illinois Supreme Court in Boyd versus Traveler Insurance stated that it would recognize the tort of intentional spoliation if given the proper circumstances. The case before the district court and this court fits within those proper circumstances because there was intentional conduct which was knowingly wrongful and which prevented the plaintiffs from proving their case. Had the videotape not been stopped, it would have shown the moment when a police officer ran up the stairs, the front stairs of the Duran home, and sprayed pepper spray into the home. Because we did not have that videotape, the jury was unwilling to believe that the defendants in this case would engage in such egregious and heinous conduct. The house was filled with women and children who were tormented by
this. Mr. Cerda, the whole concept of spoliation of evidence presupposes evidence that is already in existence. And your claim with respect to the Castaneda, was that the videographer's name? His videotaping being halted on the order of the police officer isn't about the preservation of existing evidence, but it's about the prevention of evidence from coming into being in the first place. So it's really not a spoliation claim and doesn't fit within the parameters of the Boyd case or the reservation that the court...
It's really no different because had the tape been filmed and then been destroyed, you wouldn't have known what was on the tape. Here, we won't know what would have been filmed because the videographer was stopped from videotaping. It really is not different.
It's very different and constitutes an extension of the tort beyond which the Supreme Court of Illinois seemed not willing to go.
The Illinois Supreme Court wasn't presented with the facts in Boyd, but those facts exist in this case.
So the reservation that the court made in Boyd was whether it would recognize an intentional spoliation tort as opposed to a negligent spoliation tort, but the concept of spoliation itself remained the same in the court's discussion. It's the preservation of pre-existing evidence, not an act which prevents the evidence from coming into being in the first place, and that's what your case is about.
Well, our case presents an admittedly unusual circumstance. However, the acts were clearly illegal and unlawful, and that is the tort under Illinois law to which these acts best fit. And we submit they do fit within the within this spoliation concept.
All that evidence came in, it just didn't have the tape, right?
Correct, Your Honor. It did not have the tape, and the tape was...
It would have been good to have, but it didn't exist.
Correct, Your Honor, it made it impossible for us to prove our claim because the jury simply was not willing to believe that police officers would gratuitously and vengefully spray pepper spray into a house full of women and children. We won many other claims, but we were not able to prove the claim because of that finding by the, well, because the district court was unwilling to recognize the tort of intentional exfoliation. The next issue I'd like to address is the verdicts. There's a defendants have questioned the verdicts. The verdicts, we believe, are correct and proper and should stand. The jury instructions were correct. The court entered judgments on the verdicts as they were delivered, and now the defendants question whether the court erred in entering judgment on the verdicts. If there was any error or confusion, it was caused by the verdict form submitted by the defendants, which would not have separated out when state court judgments were rendered against individual defendants or unidentified employees of the town of Cicero.
Is there any possibility of a double recovery?
There is a possibility of double recovery. There's also the possibility that the verdicts were entered against unidentified defendants. And if that is unclear, that should be held against the defendants who prepared the jury verdict form, which left that possibility for confusion.
This case was improperly tried and improperly submitted to the jury. The instructions were wrong and the verdict forms were wrong and the judgments were wrong. The town of Cicero should never have been in this case once it stipulated away its Monell liability and agreed that it would be responsible under respondeat superior because all the officers were acting within the scope of their employment. There was no factual question for the jury to decide with respect to the town. So the town should not have been in this trial at all, and the jury should not have been instructed on the town's liability and should not have filled out verdict forms on the town's liability, and that's where the problem came up. I'm really surprised that nobody understood that.
Standing here, I don't understand it because I think it's not correct because there were unidentified employees of the town.
The way to submit that question to the jury is to ask the jury to decide whether John Doe, officer number one, engaged in any of these torts, constitutional or common law, against any of the plaintiffs, and if so, what the specific plaintiffs' damages were. But when a case is submitted to the jury, damages are not awarded on a defendant-by-defendant or claim-by-claim basis. The individual plaintiffs here suffered indivisible, single injuries for which they were entitled to recover damages if any of the officers were found liable. The city agreed to all of the factual predicates for respondeat superior liability, so there was no factual question for the jury. All there was a legal question for the court at the end as to which plaintiffs the city would be liable to based on that agreement. So the town never should have been in this trial, and the jury never should have been asked to decide any questions with regard to the town's liability.
Well, plaintiffs agree that the verdict form should have been submitted by plaintiff, and we attempted to do that, and that was rejected.
Now, I understand that. There's all kinds of blame to go around for this error. It's your opposing counsel's, the trial judge's.
But the town had to be in to defend the unidentified employees.
Well, to the extent that there were unidentified employees that the town agreed to be liable for and it assumed responsibility for their defense, the town could participate in the trial. But the town's liability should not have been submitted to the jury because that was agreed to in advance. There was no factual question for the jury to answer with respect to the town's respondeat superior liability. That's a legal question once they stipulated that the officers were acting within the scope of their employment.
But I still think the district court was correct that the town had to be in the case to defend the unidentified employees, and then there had to be a verdict form submitted as to the damages against those unidentified employees.
Correct, but not as to damages against the town. The way the verdict form, as I understand it, was submitted to the jury on this very complicated case is that the jury awarded damages claim by claim and defendant by defendant, and that's not the proper way to instruct a jury, and that's not a proper way to submit a verdict form to a jury on a civil case.
Well, if there was error, it was the error of the defendants in insisting that it be done claim by claim rather than plaintiff by plaintiff, which is what we attempted to do.
The problem is not only that it was submitted claim by claim, but in terms of the damages amounts, but that it was submitted defendant by defendant. That's not a proper way to craft a jury verdict in a civil case. The jury's asked all the liability questions first as to each of the claims that each of the plaintiffs is asserting, and they answer yes or no on all those liability questions. And then the jury answers damages questions as to each plaintiff. The jury does not award damages against each defendant. That's a legal issue for the judge to craft a judgment once the jury returns a verdict on the factual questions. Damages may be itemized by category, pain and suffering, non-economic damages like pain and suffering, and humiliation, emotional distress, etc., and then economic damages may be itemized by category. That's how to properly construct a verdict form in a civil case. This verdict form was quite wrong and invited the kind of duplication of damages that we have going on here, which is your opponent's claim on appeal, that the entry of judgment by the court essentially duplicates damages. And it seems to me there's no getting around that. It does.
There is getting around that, Your Honor, because the judgments do not mirror each other, because there's a $675,000 judgment for Alejandro Duran, which doesn't mirror the $575,000 state court judge, these $575,000 verdict in favor of Alejandro Duran. So they did not mirror, and the jury was picking and choosing. They wanted to award plaintiffs a total amount, and the total amount is the amount of the verdicts against the individual defendants and the town.
You want to recover twice.
No, Your Honor, we want to
defendants, right?
No, we want to recover.
Recovering $585,000 against for the claim brought by Adolfo Duran, you want twice that. Because there were two line items for the jury, one for the individual defendants and one for the town.
There were unidentified officers who also injured.
This relates to identified officers, does it not?
There's one verdict against identified officers, then there's one verdict against the town of Cicero, and we submit that the verdicts against the town of Cicero are for unidentified defendants.
Exclusively? The award that you want against them would not count the ones that are already identified? You mean that if you total up all the identified officers and the what they did, it comes up to, I forget what, there's a number, what, a million and something or what, whatever it is. And you're saying that all of them aside, the unidentified officers should be awarded or attributed the same amount, at least, and maybe more, I guess.
Well, to make it...
What's the total that you want?
I think it's $1.7-something million dollars is outstanding.
It's still a double recovery because you don't award damages defendant by defendant. The plaintiff has a single injury. Each individual plaintiff has a single injury, and he's entitled to recover for pain and suffering, emotional distress, humiliation, and any economic damages that he can attribute to that injury. And that's how the damages question should have been put to the jury on the special verdict form, not defendant by defendant.
Well, in this...
And not with respect to the town's respondeat superior liability. That's wrong.
But in this case, they did award damages defendant claim by claim.
You're not getting my point. The jury should not have been asked to award defendant by defendant. There's one injury that the plaintiff suffers. This is basic tort law.
I understand your point, Your Honor. But that's what happened in this case, that they did go defendant by defendant, injury by injury.
Do that.
But that's what happened. We have to then reconcile the verdicts. And
no, we have to. I mean, you should take yes for an answer. This means the damages aspect of this case were very poorly tried and perhaps need to be retried.
Well, Your Honor,
which is what you want, right?
We want damages against the unidentified damage.
You just want to tally everything up and get your double recovery. You don't want a retrial on damages.
We don't think it's a double recovery, Your Honor. So move on to the next two issues. With regard to the unfairness of the trial, we have we believe that the district court improperly excluded evidence of against defendant Peslak. Defendant Peslak was involved in an incident where he slammed a guy's head on a hood, causing 5 stitches. He was in his capacity as a police officer. He pled guilty to the use of force in that incident, but he did not plead guilty to the. Perhaps I'll reserve my time on rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Ms. Thorpe.
Good morning. I'm Marcy Thorpe. I represent the town of Cicero. At this point, Your Honor, I think based on your comments, I might like to start with the issue of the double recovery.
That's a good idea.
And you know what? I can't just say that you're wrong. I understand your points, obviously. You're right. The case law is pretty clear. When there's a single indivisible injury, you don't separate out the defendants. I
Who's
think
responsible for this verdict form?
Of course, it's the trial judge. And I'll take that. But let me just add in a couple of things that I would like to say for that. I think this was a joint effort. It was supposed to be a joint effort. And I think Judge Grady here was given a very complex case, and you understand that. We're dealing with multiple plaintiffs, multiple defendants. We're dealing with federal claims. We're dealing with state claims. And we're dealing with claims against identified defendants, and we're dealing with claims against unidentified defendants. In addition, I think some plaintiffs are not only saying that they had a single indivisible injury, but also that they have divisible injuries. For
example, different police officers did different things to different people at different times during this episode.
Exactly. And I'm just going to jump out and state, for example, malicious prosecution would be one. There isn't, or some plaintiffs do have divisible injuries, which is where you would want to separate defendants and get a finding. And one other point that I'm going to say on behalf of the defendant police officers, they also had a right to know what the jury was finding that they did. And another good example that jumps out is defendant Rhonda Gross. And she was accused of doing all sorts of things, spraying people in the face and the kids and everything. And there were, of course, line items for the jury to find against each defendant. And in the end, she was found not liable for those. She was only found liable for the false arrest of, I believe it was the Uribes. So she had a right to find out what people, the jury, found that she did wrong. And I think you, can I, well, go ahead.
Yeah, that's subsumed in the liability questions on the verdict, which come first when a special verdict form is crafted in a civil case. You ask all the liability questions with respect to each theory of relief, each cause of action that each plaintiff has asserted against each defendant, and the jury answers all of those yes or no. You know, did the defendant do this to the plaintiff, yes or no? Was it a cause of damage, yes or no? And then when the damages questions are asked at the back end of the verdict, the categories of damages may be separately listed, you know, for the reasons that Judge Ripple has stated, that there might be more than one injury. In many cases, perhaps there wasn't, it was a single indivisible injury, but where there is more than one injury, then those can be itemized, but it's not, the jury doesn't award damages against a defendant. That's what the judge does when judgment is entered. The jury assesses damages for different categories of injury or measures of damages, and then we avoid the double recovery problem that way. That wasn't done here. This just invited duplication of damages, the way this verdict form was structured. I'm not sure what the remedy is because you asked for this.
And I would, and I think what Judge Grady did was take a very complex case and do the best he could with it. And if we take what he did and what he chose to do, then he drafted, or we have the jury instruction that explains we're not going to have a double recovery, award the same amount for the individual defendants against the town of Cicero and the unidentified defendants against the town of Cicero. So if we start from there, that's what we have.
Well, where are you starting with the identified and your, because I assume that you've already paid all of the, I guess the plaintiffs that have a recovery.
Yes.
Now the question is there anything else? Is there additional? Is there a surplus? Is there more that is still owed? It's just not to whom. Certainly not a double recovery, but is there, you know, $100,000 or something? I guess what I'm trying to figure out from what we've got here is the what's the total amount over the amount you've already paid that might be owed?
I believe it would be $1,730,000, and that would be the amount that would equal, in addition to what the defendants were awarded, or what the plaintiffs were awarded for individual defendants.
No, that's just doubling it, isn't it?
Yes.
No, I'm asking if, without doubling it, is there an amount in excess of what you've already paid that could be owed based on the unidentified people?
No.
And it's there's not, for instance, in that example where there was $100,000, $650,000 as opposed to $550,000. Is that $100,000, where'd that come from?
Where that came from is that $575,000 were awarded against individual defendants.
Yeah.
$675,000 was awarded against the town of Cicero. $675,000 equals the amounts for the identified defendants, $575,000, plus $100,000 for unidentified defendants, and that, Your Honor, has been paid. If that's your, I think that's your question.
Oh, you paid that $100,000 also?
Correct. Correct.
So
we've paid
five. You paid for each and every officer who did damage.
Yes. And the unidentified
including
defendants.
Including the unidentified.
Yes.
The only thing represented by the judgment outstanding against you is your respondeat superior liability, which is, in fact, the same liability as the one you've just paid.
Correct. Okay. Yes.
Now, why don't you have a proper avenue for relief under Rule 60B? Why can't you go to the district court and ask that the judgment be amended to show accord and satisfaction?
I think we could do that.
Well, then why are you here?
Well, we hadn't paid immediately, and we had to appeal to preserve the issue. And we asked the trial court during our post-trial motion to amend the judgment.
Seemed to me that basically what you're doing is you're trying to get resolved in this appeal something that happened post-judgment.
That happened in the judgment order.
Well, that happened post-judgment. You paid. Now you want to make sure that you don't have to pay twice. That's your problem.
Yes, that would be one way to put it, but then we also at the beginning asked to have the judgment order amended, to preserve the issue in case they did try to recover more.
But you have a remedy for that.
At this point, we believe we do. Yes, because we have paid, and we think that the judgment should be released as satisfied or vacated as satisfied.
When do you find you filed a notice of appeal at some point, which takes the jurisdiction away from the district court? And subsequent to that, apparently, then you did this other transaction.
Then we paid. Yes.
So is maybe what we're getting at is the court doesn't have a jurisdiction. We'd have to basically remand it for, I guess, some kind of a motion for under 60B to have him reconsider or whatever to sort this out because, after all the discussion here, we obviously got it. I thought it was a big mess on the qualified immunity case, but it's not any better here. What's the remedy that we can do that you can resolve if this goes back to the district court?
Well,
you talk about confusion and award double recovery. Now that you've paid a specific amount to everyone, this seems to have advanced a lot before what was before the district court.
Right. What was before the district court, we asked him to amend his order, and he just flat out denied it.
And you hadn't paid by that time?
We had not paid. We filed our appeal. We paid. I believe, actually, by the time I filed the initial brief, we still hadn't completed payment for certain individuals or maybe unidentified individuals. But now we have definitely paid all the judgments. And at that point, I mean, I believe you, Your Honors, could go ahead and vacate the judgment orders against the town of Cicero, and that's what we're asking you to do.
You're not entitled to have them vacated if you've satisfied them.
Or released, I'm sorry, or released as satisfied.
That's not a remedy that you ask a court of appeals for in the first instance, as Judge Ripple pointed out. As I understand the judgments as they stand right now, they authorize double recovery for those plaintiffs for whom the same dollar amount of damages was entered in the judgment against the individual defendants and against the town of Cicero. You haven't paid $585,000 twice to Adolfo Duran, have you? You've only paid it once.
Correct.
And the whole point of your appeal, as I understood it, is that as the judgments now stand, you're on the hook for twice because there's a line item in the judgment for the individual defendants and there's a line item in the judgment for the town to pay for the same amount. And unless that's unless the judgment is amended to make it clear that that's joint and several liability, not double recovery, then you've got to pay twice.
We don't believe we have to pay twice. I think we believe that we would just like the judgment order to say that it was entered jointly against the individual defendants and the town. I think our position would remain the same. It was always meant to be joint. The injury instruction.
Right, but the point is that judgment doesn't say that now. Now it says
the orders, you're correct, don't say that, and that's what we asked to have done.
With respect to most of these plaintiffs, the order has two damages awards, one against the individual defendants and one against the town, which are not joint and several.
13 plaintiffs that we've identified. And my time is up unless you have more questions.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. May it please the Court. My name is Emmanuel Welch, and I am here to represent the individual police officer defendants, Officer Dino Vitallo and Officer William Peslak, who are defendant appellees in this matter. I think it's appropriate to start this morning with acknowledging, as Your Honors' questions have clearly indicated, that this was a very complicated case for Your Honor, Judge Grady, to try. However, we are here this morning with respect to the evidentiary rulings that Judge Grady made to say Judge Grady got it right with regard to Officer Vitale and Officer Peslak. Judge Grady ruled. He oversaw this case for 7 years. He sat through 6 long weeks of trial testimony. He was able to gauge witnesses' credibility. Judge Grady got it right. Plaintiffs asked the jury at the end of the evidence for $22 million, but they only got $3 million. So what they are before your honors here this morning asking this court to do is they're really asking this honorable court to give them a second bite at the apple. But they're not entitled to that second bite at the apple. In order to get that second bite at the apple, they would have to show that Judge Grady abused his discretion in those evidentiary rulings. We believe, with respect to the evidentiary rulings, Judge Grady got it right for 3 reasons. One, he did not abuse his discretion when he barred 404B evidence because he specifically found, with regard to Officer Vitale under Rule 403, that that evidence was too prejudicial. Two, Judge Grady did not abuse his discretion when he ruled that Officer Vitale did not open the door to 404B evidence, again concluding under Rule 403 that that evidence was too prejudicial. He was extremely concerned as well with the case being tried with 11 other individual police officers about the spillover effect of allowing that type of evidence into the trial. And three, Judge Grady did not abuse his discretion in barring the evidence of Officer Peslak's misdemeanor conviction because that didn't involve a crime of dishonesty, nor did it involve any type of false statement as Rule 609A requires under the Federal Rules of Evidence. According to Simplex, Inc. versus Diversified Energy Systems, this honorable court held a long time ago that the decision whether to admit evidence is a matter specifically within the discretion of the trial court, and that the trial court would only be reversed if there was clear abuse of discretion. Despite that longstanding standard, plaintiffs are still before you this morning alleging that Judge Grady erred by not allowing 404B evidence. Judge Grady did not abuse his discretion. Judge Grady relied on longstanding precedent like Treese versus Hostetter, another case that this honorable court decided. This court specifically stated in the Treese case that prior bad acts is admissible only when it meets a four-prong test. When you review the trial transcript, Judge Grady, in his ruling specifically, found that two of those prongs were missing. One, he thought the evidence was propensity evidence. It was specifically propensity evidence, he said in the record, as 404A testimony. He also believed, over and over again, that under 403, the evidence that plaintiffs wanted to introduce with regard to Officers Vitale and Officer Peslak was too prejudicial. In the Treese case, this honorable court said that in reviewing a judge's determination of the admissibility of Rule 404B evidence, we must accord great deference to the trial court's assessments because of the judge's firsthand impression of the case. He's there. He's gauging the witnesses. He's seeing the evidence as it's going in. That's what happened in this case. Judge Grady used the Treese standards when he made the decisions he made with regard to the Rule 404B evidence. He was aware of this case in some instances better than the lawyers. He oversaw the case for 7 years. Plaintiffs were merely seeking to use hearsay allegations against Officer Vitale to play to the jury's passions and prejudices. And Judge Grady saw right through those tactics. It's right there on the record, trial transcript, page 1095, lines 9 through 13, that he thought that that material was too prejudicial.
Was the 404B evidence with respect to Officer Vitale in the nature of complaints that were filed with the town or complaints that actually had been adjudicated and that he had found had been found substantiated?
Well, they were mostly complaints that had been filed with the town.
They were unsubstantiated.
Plaintiffs contend that there were 4 sustained complaints, but there were never any witnesses brought forth.
Well, what's in the town's records, though? If it was a substantiated complaint, there would have been some form of discipline, right?
There were. there were Officer Vitallo did receive some form of discipline from the town of Cicero. However, Officer Vitallo's sustained complaints and his discipline was irrelevant in this case, especially once the town stipulated on the Monell claim. As Judge Grady found in the record, that if he were to allow this type of evidence, it would have been against the town in the Monell claim to show that they had some type of notice. But in the case in chief that we were dealing with, when you had 12 police officers on trial at the same time, to allow that type of evidence would have been spillover evidence against those other defendants. It would have been too prejudicial. Once you ring that bell, you can't unring that bell. And we believe that Judge Grady, who sat there and watched the evidence go into trial, got it right. He did not abuse his discretion, and we believe he should be affirmed with regard to the evidentiary ruling related to Officer Vitallo. We also believe that he should be affirmed with regard to Officer William Peslett. Plaintiffs believe that the judge should have allowed evidence of a misdemeanor conviction before the jury. According to Federal Rule of Evidence 609A, evidence can be used for the purpose of attacking the truthfulness of a witness when one of two things occurs. Either, one, a witness has been convicted of a crime punishable by death or imprisonment in excess of 1 year under the law of which the witness was convicted, and the probative value of admitting the evidence outweighs its prejudicial effect. When reviewing the trial transcript records, Judge Grady clearly believed, number one, the conviction that he was convicted of in excess of 1 year. It was a conviction for deprivation of civil rights, and that sentence could not exceed 1 year. He also believed to admit it was too prejudicial. He thought it was flat out. His quote was, it was flat out 404A testimony.
Mr. Welsh, in the case of Officer Vitallo, after he suggested that he was not prejudiced against Mexicans, indeed had family members who were Mexican, of Mexican ancestry, could he have been on recross, could he have been asked under Rule 608B about these incidents of brutality against Mexican Americans?
Your Honor, I don't believe Officer Vitallo opened the door to that type of testimony. Judge Grady, I see that I'm out of time. May I complete your answer? Judge Grady sat there the entire time. He gauged the witness's credibility. He saw the evidence going in. And I honestly believe he got it right. He didn't abuse his discretion by keeping that evidence out because, as he said in his own words, to then allow recross with that type of information, it would go to the spillover effect on the other defendants. And he had to monitor the whole trial with regard to all of the defendants. And for that reason, I believe he got it right. In quick conclusion, I just ask Your Honors, with regard to the evidentiary rulings related to Officer Vitallo and Officer Peslett, to affirm Judge Grady's decisions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Cerda, how much time? You have 4 minutes.
With regard to the verdicts, it's speculation that the verdicts are double recovery verdicts because they do not mirror each other. We have a $675,000 verdict and a $575,000 verdict. They're not mirrors. We submit that they are against the unidentified employees, and it was the intention, for example, to award Adolfo Duran $575,000 for the acts of identified employees and $585,000.
The city has paid for the torts of the unidentified officers.
They paid for the torts of the identified officers, not for the torts.
Well, somebody's not telling us the truth right here. Oh, that's right. Council just represented that they have, in fact, paid for the torts of the unidentified officers. You're telling me that they did not.
They paid for the torts of the unidentified officers in one respect, but not in another respect. For example, the claim I was speaking of, Adolfo Duran, there's a claim against identified officers in the amount of $585,000, and there's also a claim against the town of Cicero in the amount of $585,000. We submit that that claim against the town of Cicero under $585,000.
What was the basis of the claim against the town of Cicero?
respondeat superior, which included not just the identified defendants, but the unidentified defendants. We tried to submit the claim, the jury verdict form by plaintiff, which would have made this clear. The defendants didn't. This issue was known at the time the verdicts were announced. Defendants' counsel had time to take us up with the court, but didn't. I'd like to quickly move on to Vitalo. Vitalo had sustained complaints, entered into a plea agreement, and these for incidents prior to this to this incident. And during the trial, Vitalo, on direct examination through his counsel, volunteered they had no prejudice against Mexicans because his wife is Mexican. And then his counsel then asked him about his kid, and he said, so your kid is Mexican? Yes. So the leading question. Then in a summation for an argument, he said, you've got to, you know, here's Vitalo, who's married to a Mexican. Plaintiffs have it all wrong.
Did you attempt to ask him about these complaints?
We were not permitted to do so. Yes.
Was there ever a discussion of recross?
Yes. Yes, there is.
On the record.
On the record, Your Honor. Absolutely. And with regard to Peslak was convicted of a civil rights violation, which was punishable for 10 years, up to 10 years. So it was more than 1 year. The district court did not analyze it under. Properly under 609. Under Rule 404B, he concluded that this was for it was for the beating, but the beating really involved impeachment because during the beating, he filed a false police report about the beating. We could have impeached him about you did this beating, you file a false police report about this beating, and then you got your buddy to state under oath that he was at the scene and saw it the way you did when his buddy was convicted for lying about that. He submitted a false police report. There was abundant evidence to impeach Officer Peslak. The worst actors in this case were Deciani, Vitalo, and Peslak. We were astounded they got off. Vitalo got off because of his plea to, well, look, I'm married to a Mexican. I have a kid to a Mexican. I would never do these things. We should have been able to go into this without a defendant's counsel opening the door. But once defendant's counsel opened the door on direct examination twice and in summation, we should have been allowed to go there, and we were not. And with regard to Peslak, and so we ask that we be granted a new trial and that Rule 36 not apply in revamp.
All right. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.